Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time for A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show, and it's hosted by Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's jump right into today's program. Carol Marks, here, front and center, in conversation with Denise Kiernan. She's author of a book titled The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II, published by Touchstone, Simon & Schuster.
Before we talk about the women that you interviewed for the book, let's talk a little bit about that town of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where they lived. I know it came into being overnight, so how many people were there when it first got started up in 1942? And how many eventually came to live there by 1945?
Oak Ridge, Tennessee, in eastern Tennessee, about 20 miles outside of Knoxville, was purpose-built. So it was not a town that existed previously that was repurposed for the Manhattan Project during the war. It's roughly about 50, it was roughly about 58,000 acres during World War II, and on that land were a number of very small communities and hamlets, things of that nature. And roughly 1,000 families were moved off that land to make way for the creation of Site X, as it was called at the time, or Oak Ridge. So they broke ground there late 1942, and by mid-1945, population had grown to 75,000 people, and they were using more electricity than New York City and had one of the nation's largest bus systems. So it really just exploded population-wise as they continued to bring more and more people in to work on the project.
You know, it's just unbelievable. And what really grabbed my attention was the kind of agreements that the women had to sign before they went to work. I mean, what was involved with that?
Well, everybody who, I mean, during World War II, we've all heard phrases like loose lips sink ships mm-hmm. and things of that nature. So secrecy was viewed as important. You weren't supposed to discuss your son's troop movements, for example, if you happened to know them or he wrote a letter talking about them. And people were very careful to talk about what they worked on. So for the Manhattan Project, that level of secrecy was taken to an extreme. And people who worked on the project, you know, men and women had to sign, you know, the Espionage Act. They were quizzed about whether or not they would be comfortable keeping a secret from their spouse or from a sibling or a parent. And there were reminders everywhere that not only were you not supposed to talk about your work with people who were from outside of Oak Ridge, you weren't supposed to talk about your work with other people who were living and working in Oak Ridge. You were really only supposed to discuss what you were doing with someone on the job if you absolutely needed to. So even within the confines of Oak Ridge itself, just having chit-chat in the cafeteria about what you were working on was a big no-no.
And did the fact that each of the workers was trained only to do a specific task kind of make it easier for keeping secrets?
Absolutely. Compartmentalization was key to maintaining the secrecy of the Manhattan Project, and it was used throughout the project. Basically, what that meant was if, for example, your job was inspecting pipes, this was actually the job of one of the women I profiled, you were trained how to inspect pipes. That was it. You were trained how to do that to the best of your abilities, but you had no idea where those pipes were coming from. You had no idea where those pipes were going. You had no idea what those pipes were going to be carrying or where they were going to be installed because you didn't need to know that part. So you were only given as much information as you needed to do your job exceptionally well and not an ounce more.
Now, in your book, you tell the stories of 9 women. How did you find them, and how old were they?
Well, let's see. My youngest right now is about to turn 88, so that's how old they are now. And I'm still in touch with the women. The oldest is 96. Katie is 96, and the youngest is 88. Once I found that picture that you mentioned at the beginning of our talk, I looked on a map and realized that Oak Ridge was only about 2 hours' drive from my home in Asheville, North Carolina. So I hopped in the car and drove over there to see what it was that I could find. And, you know, basically once I found a, you know, a contact there, a local historian who put me in touch with one person, it was a man named Connie Bowling. He was 101 when I interviewed him. We went to go to his assisted living facility to do the interview, and in the lobby, I met Colleen and Dot, two women who ended up being two of the women I profile in the book. And it's with everyone I met, they were eager to introduce me to other people that they knew in the area that had lived and worked in Oak Ridge during the war. So it really kind of spread. One person would introduce me to two more who would introduce me to someone else, or I'd go to historic preservation meetings. I sat in the lobby of assisted living centers stalking octogenarians, you know, asking them if they had been there during the war. So it was all done. I tracked them down there on site.
It was, you know, difficult for some of the women, you know, to leave home and have all the secrets that they had to keep. But the government made a very important promise to men and women that it recruited there. And they said everything will be taken care of for them. And boy, they certainly provided a lot of amenities for them.
That's true. And it was a challenging situation for people, because you have to imagine, we talk about how quickly the town was built. So, you know, there weren't proper sidewalks yet. There was a lot of mud because of the constant construction. It was very crowded because the population was growing much more. They needed many more workers than they originally anticipated. So housing was crowded. There were round-the-clock shifts, so that was stressful. But the thing that the government did was also create all of these recreational activities as a way to help keep morale up. So there were dances several times a week. There were athletic leagues for pretty much every sport you can imagine. There were hiking trips. There was a rabbit breeders club. I'm not entirely sure. I guess that was a very club that operated very quickly. So they did all of these things so that when the people weren't working, that they had an opportunity to relax at least a little bit and also get to know the people who were there with them, because everybody there came from somewhere else.
And although the government was very progressive in the opportunities provided for white women and men, you know, I mean, because this facility was located in the South, they still had a lot of segregation policies, and I was amazed that a woman couldn't live with her husband if she was an African American, or as they in those days call them, Negroes.
That's right. Oak Ridge was fully segregated. This was the early 1940s in Tennessee, and in many ways, Oak Ridge was a reflection of the area in which it was placed. However, they also made it so that, as you mentioned, even African-American husbands and wives were not permitted to live together. There were visiting hours. So Katie, a woman I profile in my book, she was allowed to visit her husband, you know, during certain hours of the day, and guards would come by and check to make sure that the women had left by curfew. And one of the more heartbreaking aspects of that segregation was that they were also not allowed to bring their children. So Katie and her husband Willie, who I talk about in the book, had to leave their children behind in Alabama. They were lucky that they had Katie's mother there to take care of them, and they sent money home constantly. And the money they earned in Oak Ridge was significantly better than they would have been able to earn back home, which was one of the reasons that they endured this ill treatment.
And, you know, I'm glad you wrote about it, because we do need to be reminded of it. Now, fast forwarding to August 6th of 1945, the atomic bomb gets dropped for the first time, but the workers at Oak Ridge still don't know what they have created. So when they found out, what was their reaction?
There were a variety of reactions, and the way people found out was very interesting, because, of course, there was no television. There was either radio, newspaper, or word of mouth. So if you were working in a plant, you may not have found out until after some other folks who were maybe home with the kids, for example, or out shopping. On that day, the first bit of information was just that there was this new super weapon that no one had ever seen before. And then it was that the president was going to give an address. So people who could, gathered around to listen to the president's address. And sure enough, towards the end of that address, Oak Ridge is mentioned as being a site involved with this new super weapon, which came to be called, you know, the atomic bomb. And that really floored people. But what was interesting was that even though the big secret was out, in a sense, you know, what Oak Ridge had been working on, the specifics of what each individual person did was not necessarily revealed to them. And the message was, you know, keep on at work. There's no, you know, work doesn't stop. There's, you know, we still have, you know, more to do. So people were processing a wide variety of information. On the one hand, people were so happy that the war was about to come to an end. I mean, World War II affected everyone's lives so deeply, and it really touched everyone in this country. And to have the war be over was a huge relief. At the same time, the people who worked on the project were dealing with the fact that they were involved in something that did create a tremendous amount of devastation. And the extent of that devastation really became clear over months because, you know, initially all they learned about is what the bomb's initial effects were, but then, you know, months and even years later, more was learned about radiation sickness and things of, and fallout and things of that nature. And so, you know, for the people involved, one woman I interviewed, I think, put it best. She said, you know, I was so happy the war was over because my brother was coming home and I missed him very much and was worried about him. She said, but I was very sad because I really love people and so many people died when the bomb was dropped. And I think that kind of captures the complexity of feelings that a lot of these people were dealing with.
That's Denise Kiernan in conversation with Carol Marx. Her book is titled The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. It's published by Touchstone, Simon & Schuster. And if you want more information, go to the website denisekiernan.com. Carol Marx returns with more conversation when A Touch of Gray continues.
Did you know there are other signs of rosacea besides facial redness, pimples, and visible blood vessels? Other symptoms may include burning, stinging, or swelling of the face, and even enlargement of the nose. Rosacea can also affect the eyes, causing a bloodshot appearance and irritation that could lead to vision loss. If you have any sign of rosacea, see a dermatologist or visit the National Rosacea Society at rosacea.org.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. Michael Harrison here in the anchor chair, and again, our host, Carol Marx, this time in conversation with Jessica Wapner. Jessica is a freelance science writer focused on healthcare and medicine. She's going to talk to Carol about her book titled The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level.
What made you want to write The Philadelphia Chromosome in the first place?
Well, so many things. I mean, first there's this amazing story of science and medicine where the genetic mutation that was originally spotted in 1959 over decades of research was connected with this disease, chronic myeloid leukemia. The medical advances that allowed that connection to take place were fascinating to me. The whole history of recombinant DNA, or cloning as we call it, the understanding of the genetic underpinnings of cancer, which was not known about when this mutation was first spotted. But then also there's this amazing human story behind it all of these people who had a vision to create this miracle drug and were willing to go to miraculous lengths themselves to make that vision into a reality.
So let's go back a bit to the Philadelphia chromosome itself, and who discovered it, and how was it discovered, and why was it such a landmark discovery?
Well, it was first spotted in 1959 by these two scientists, Peter Knoll and David Hungerford, in Philadelphia, which is why it's called the Philadelphia chromosome. They were just looking at cells through microscopes, and one day David Hungerford, who would just love to observe, he just loved natural observation. He was looking at some cells from patients with chronic myeloid leukemia, and he noticed that one of the chromosomes was too small. It was quite amazing that he even noticed it, because this was just microscopes. The chromosomes looked at the time just like these inky blobs, very indistinct. And he was one of very few people in the world who could have even noticed it. But he did. And at the time, there was no technology and no understanding to take that discovery any further until the 1970s, when finally some technology became available, allowing people not just to look at chromosomes, but to see inside them. And that began setting the stage for this unfolding picture of how this mutation leads to chronic myeloid leukemia.
Would you say in layman's terms that they were able to find the gene, that it was really like finding a needle in a haystack?
Absolutely. I mean, and a giant, giant haystack, right? I mean, so, and you know, as people understand cancer today, that needle in a haystack has to be found among other needles appearing while you're searching, and never knowing which one is the one that you're after, never knowing which one is the one driving the cancer. That's part of why it's a very difficult search to find the genetic underpinnings of cancer.
And it's also very difficult to discover which chromosomes have been interchanged, I would imagine, or shortened.
Yes, that's right. And in this case, it was discovered in 1971 by a geneticist named Janet Rowley at the University of Chicago. She is absolutely beloved in the field, and she would look at these chromosomes. I love this image of, she had chromosomes that were, she could see the banding inside with this new technique called fluorescent banding that became available in the 1970s. And so they look like stripes. It turns the chromosomes into these striped patterns. And she would every day be taking pictures of the chromosomes inside cells of patients with various leukemias and sit at night cutting them out. And her children, her four children, would ask her, who was paying her to play with paper dolls, right? That's what they look like when you're cutting them out. Headless paper dolls, I suppose. So, and she realized that not only was there this one chromosome that David Hungerford had spotted that was too small in patients with chronic myeloid leukemia, but there was another one that was too big. And so she was the first person to realize that the Philadelphia chromosome was what's called a translocation, a swap. Two chromosomes are swapping a tiny bit of genetic material, and that tiny change is enough to cause this fatal disease.
And, you know, really, that's mind-boggling research. So after, and this happened around 1990, the mutant gene, they discovered more about it, and then there was a race, really, among doctors and researchers to target chronic myeloid leukemia and find something that would help it. So for those who don't know, who won the race and what is Gleevec?
Right. So that's right. In the mid-1980s, people began thinking, well, let's make a drug to target this. Once the root cause was known, and the drug actually targets the protein, the mutant protein encoded by this mutant gene, once that was known, people began to think, well, could we make a drug to target it? And they did. And the story of how that happened is amazing, and you know, will turn anyone into, turned me into a chemistry lover. It's just fascinating. And the drug was made by a company at the time called Ciba-Geigy, which was in Switzerland. They later merged with another company and became Novartis, which is the company that exists today. The brand name of the drug is Gleevec, and it was approved by the FDA in 2001. The struggle to get the drug made goes through all kinds of twists and turns, and it took a very long time. There were many delays for different reasons, but in 2001, when the drug was approved, it was the fastest approval to date because the drug was so successful.
Now, in one of the most interesting parts of your book, that's a foreword, Dr. Robert Weinberg says that the development of Gleevec might never have occurred because of financial concerns. And what did he mean? And isn't that true today with a lot of orphan diseases where, you know, drug companies are not anxious to pursue finding something that might cure them because there are so few people and it's very expensive to develop a new drug?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's exactly what happened. This drug came so close to not being made. It's indescribable. It was really almost shelved. One of the most successful cancer drugs ever was almost not made. And that was because the patient population is very small. This is a rare disease that occurs in about 5,000 people per year in the United States. To put that in perspective, breast cancer is diagnosed in about 230,000 people in the U.S. each year. And the company couldn't see how it was going to recoup on its investment, let alone make a profit with a patient population of that size. So this was, right, this is the financial pressure that is described in the foreword and that I describe at length in the book, the many delays, the drama, the infighting within the company, the pressure from patients, because it was largely the patients at one point who rescued this drug. Finally, it did get made and eventually became a blockbuster. And that really, one of the things that this success story proved was that you could make a drug for a rare disease. And the reason why financially is because this kind of treatment needs to be taken every day for the rest of a person's life. It's very different from other types of cancer treatments like chemotherapy, which is, you know, might last for a few months, but it doesn't go on for years and years. So strictly financially speaking, this is a different kind of business model, so to speak. It's a very weird way to speak about a treatment like this, but the business model is very different. And orphan diseases or rare diseases, they have now, the U.S. government provides financial incentives, and that has helped many drug companies start making more medications for rare diseases. In addition, sometimes a company will go for the first indication of a drug for a rare disease and afterwards find other applications for it. This drug in particular has had other applications, but others have had very big implications, like Botox began as a drug for a rare disease.
Absolutely. And you know, the wonderful thing about Gleevec is that it has turned this cancer, which was fatal within a very few years, it now can be treated like a chronic disease, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's right. There's people who have been on this drug now since the very first trial opened in 1998. Judy Oram, who I met, she lives in Portland, she was one of the first patients to take this drug, and she's alive and well. She has seen the birth of her grandchildren. She has a beautiful family life, and it is entirely because this drug exists that she's alive.
Jessica Wapner in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. Go to jessicawapner.com for more information. You're plugged into A Touch of Grey.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with The Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined at this point in the program by our senior correspondent, who is also the vice president and executive editor of the radio industry trade publication, Talkers, Kevin Casey. Kevin, I do hope that you're enjoying this Father's Day weekend. I know you are a father. I am a father, and we have a number of fathers, certainly a lot of sons and daughters listening in the audience, and I don't know how much conversation is spent on talk radio talking about fathers, but I do know that everybody's trying to figure out what to buy their father, and every father's trying to figure out what to do with the gifts he gets that he doesn't want to wear or eat.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Throughout my father's lifetime, I found it to be one of the most challenging things in the world. You know, the proverbial guy who has everything, you know?
Well, my father was back in the old days when I was a child. He eventually quit. He was a cigar smoker.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was always an easy gift. We'd buy him a box of cigars, and sometimes
right.
I would, when it was a birthday or something, I really wanted to do something special for my father, I'd go down to the cigar store, we're talking when I was a little kid,
yeah.
And I'd save up my money, and I'd buy him an expensive cigar, you know, one that he would never buy for himself. I remember I once bought him a dollar cigar. Now, a dollar, back when I was a kid, was like today, you know, $100.
Well, yeah, not quite, but yeah.
You could spend a whole day out on a buck.
Yeah, as a kid.
As a kid, yeah.
Sure.
You have lunch,
get into the movies, get on a bus. You know, things were like in increments of 10 cents, 15 cents. A cigar back in those days was probably, a nickel cigar was considered a cheap cigar. An expensive cigar was like a quarter. So if you bought a dollar cigar, that was luxury.
Wow.
And I once bought him a dollar cigar, and he said, why did you spend all that money on me? But I'm you know what I think the most dangerous thing you can buy somebody is a tie, a necktie. Do you? How many neckties do you own?
I own about a dozen or more, but hardly wear them anymore.
You hardly wear ties, or you hardly wear the dozen that you have?
No, I hardly wear ties anymore, so it's not something, you know, it's... In fact, a lot of guys don't. It's even people who go into a very big office every day, it's very often casual much of the time.
Yeah. The tie is not as necessary anymore for a man to wear. But I still occasionally wear ties, and when I do, I find that I probably wear the same five ties. And I own approximately 200 ties.
Oh, my gosh.
They clog up my closet. Some of them I've never worn.
You know, back in the day when my father was, you know, going to the office every day, the styles of ties didn't change as quickly as they do now. Now, ties go out of style, so to speak, about every 18 months.
Yeah, well, unfortunately for me, I don't know what's in style and out of style. So, you know, and to people that those things really matter, you really come across as a dork. To people it doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter. They don't care. But people who are very, very fashion conscious, they judge you. They judge you by the size of your lapels. They judge you by the tie. They judge you by your shoes. And most men, and I'm not getting into any kind of judgment here, it's just an observation, most men are not that fashion conscious.
True.
But there are some that are. And it's funny, you don't know what people are thinking. And people judge you by your car, they judge you by your house, and then other people couldn't care less.
Right.
And you don't always know. But, so you have about five ties, huh?
Yeah, well, no, I got about a dozen or more. Oh. I actually thinned out the herd recently when I was going through the closet.
Yeah, yeah. You know what, we don't have a lot of time left, but you know what I don't like? I don't like novelty ties. I don't like ties that, you know, guy's all well-dressed and he's got Mickey Mouse or something.
Right.
Right. I'm not a fan of that. Well, listen, happy Father's Day to you. Happy Father's Day to me and to all the fathers out there. And let's get through this weekend. And,
right. And enjoy that new tie.
Enjoy those ties. Absolutely. Thank you, Kevin Casey. Kevin Casey is the Vice President and Executive Editor of Talkers. It's located at talkers.com. If you're interested in what's going on behind the scenes in the talk radio industry and then some, check out talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor seat, and A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here's our senior correspondent Steve Wiseman with us the rest of the way, talking to Bruce Feiler, journalist and New York Times columnist, the author of The Council of Dads, Abraham, and Walking the Bible, which became a PBS special. His new book is titled, listen to this, The Secrets of Happy Families, Improve Your Mornings, Rethink Family Dinner, Fight Smarter, Go Out and Play, and much more, published by William Morrow.
Bruce, you quote Tolstoy right in the beginning. Tolstoy said all happy families are alike. Do you think so? What are the common ingredients of happy families?
Well, when I first encountered that line when I was a teenager, all happy families are alike, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way, I thought it was idiotic. Of course, happy families are alike, right? There's big ones, there's small ones, there's loud ones, there's quiet ones. But I have to say I've changed my mind because we know more. Even in the last 5-10 years, there's been amazing research about what makes groups and teams work effectively. We've rethought dinner, discipline, difficult conversations. And I do think there are certain things in common. And as you know, I sort of outline them in the book. These are not things that everybody must do to have a happy family, but these are things that families do in common. And I think the three big themes are they adapt all the time, they talk a lot, and they go out and play.
You know, I love your emphasis on playfulness throughout there, and the fact that we got to get serious about this because it really is important, and it makes us feel good, too, and it brings us together, right?
The research shows that families should spend less time worrying about what they do wrong and more time focusing on what they do right. It seems simple, but in fact, it's quite hard. All families have conflict. As you know, I have actually probably 3 chapters in this book about how to fight smarter, how to have difficult conversations, particularly about aging parents and dealing with issues of extended families when they're adults. There's lots of knowledge about this, including amazing new thinking about where to sit and how to stand and what rooms and what times of day to have difficult conversations. But there's also we can do things to play more and play better and play smarter. And I went to see the folks at Zynga about coming up with new games for families. I went to talk to the Green Berets because, after all, who is better at bringing different people together than the military? In fact, they've studied it for 50 years. And they have a lot of ideas about how to build up bonding. And the idea is if you have positive experiences, reunions or vacations or even walks in the park, you will deepen that bond so that when you get to the conflict part of being a family, which will happen a lot, you'll have the connection and the confidence to push through.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the family reunions and the family vacation, because I got to admit that was the first I jumped to that first before I even started at the beginning. Our family has big, major family reunions every year and planned vacations, and they're pretty good, but there are certain repeated patterns that bring about stress. And I'm looking at this going, the Green Beret Guide to Perfect Family Vacation. And the more I read, I'm going, wow, that makes sense. That makes sense. We can do that. Certain kinds of lists, certain kinds of activities. That one really rang with me. Now, have you put some of that into your own family and your vacations?
Absolutely. We have both my family and my wife's family, which have very different dynamics. We meet for these extended reunions, and the different generations would retreat into separate corners. The different families went, oh, that one likes to sleep late, that one likes to go to bed early, whatever it might be. And there are simple things you can do. For example, dividing up into teams, getting different generations, grandparents, parents, children, together working. And then suddenly grandma's telling a story to the grandchild about the old days, aunts and uncles from different families who may not work together, may have some tension. They're writing a cheer. Suddenly, in our family, we do a play. In my wife's family, it's sort of outdoor backyard games. The activities don't matter. It's actually, it's the cooperation that makes different connections so that when you're in saying, who's going to take out the trash tonight and who's going to do the dishes, you have that connection.
And let me also add that this book it's not just a sort of a how-to for Secrets of Happy Families. It's a very funny read. Yeah, it is an enjoyable, enjoyable book. Now, speaking of enjoyable, hopefully this is a good link. You have Secrets to a Happy Marriage in there as part of the family. And a happy marriage is a cornerstone in a happy family, isn't it?
Well, it can be. Obviously, there are single-parent families that can be very high-functioning. But, yes, the core relationship can be key. And a lot of what we've been told there is also stale, speaking of the family experts giving us the same old advice. Date night, for example. If you just go to a dinner and a movie, it's not going to have much impact, actually. The research shows if you do something new, if you get lost or drive to a new part of town, cook a new recipe, take a class, you will actually rekindle those chemicals of when you're first meeting, and it will help to rejuvenate. Same thing with double dating. This is another idea that we've used after working on this book. We have a couple, we actually don't even talk about their kids. We get together, the four of us, and have a conversation that's just like we're all getting to know one another, very renewing. The truth is actually too much intimacy is actually bad for a long-term relationship. You need a little bit of mystery and newness. That's actually the way to keep your relationship fresh.
You know, and every time I would read some chapter, I would say, wow, yeah, that's right, that's right, that's right. Why did I not think of that? Now, what about arguing? Arguments will happen, and it cracked me up that just as you went to Warren Buffett for how to set an allowance, you went to the Harvard Negotiation Project for how to argue. What's the best way to argue?
Well, my wife and I were having this 7:42 fight. We would put our girls down when they were younger. We'd get together. We'd say, who's dropping off the dry cleaning? Who's picking up the milk? And suddenly we would be at each other's throats. So I said, there must be a better way. So I went to these guys at the Harvard Negotiation Project. They deal with Israeli-Palestinian peace problems, with nuclear arms treaties, and you guys must have some tips. Turns out
their
blueprint is actually very, very effective. And so we've made a lot of changes. First of all, research shows that the highest tension time in families is between 6 and 8. So 7:42, the worst time to have a fight. So we've changed when we have this conversation. We changed where. We were doing it in my office. I was at my desk. It's hard. I've got computer equipment, lots of things that were making my wife, who was sitting lower in another chair. Turns out I was in the power position. She was arms crossed, resentful, negative energy right from the beginning. So we moved, and we no longer sit across from each other. You're more likely to be confrontational. And if we're having a really difficult talk, we've actually moved to this window bench in my bedroom, in our bedroom, because we sit next to each other. And research shows sit next to someone, you'll be more collaborative. So look, here's the larger point. There are all these ideas out there about fighting, about game playing, about having adaptability, about what to talk about when you're in the dinner or in the car. It's just cut off from the parents who need it most.
Yeah.
My thinking was, let's flood this into families. I want to put lots of new ideas out here and, tell a few funny stories and some research. And I'm not wagging my finger saying these are the three things you got to do. I'm saying here's a lot of new ideas, but if you pick three, you'll have a happier family in a week.
Bruce Feiler, in conversation with Steve Wiseman, his book is titled The Secrets of Happy Families, Improve Your Mornings, Rethink Family Dinner, Fight Smarter, Go Out and Play, and much more. Great title. William Morrow is the publisher. Steve Wiseman returns. I'm Michael Harrison. More coming your way when A Touch of Grey continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/GOV delivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/GOV delivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Now we come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast and the return of Steve Wiseman. Steve Wiseman is a prolific writer. He's written a number of great books. The Truth About Avoiding Scams is one of them. It's published by Prentice Hall. And he also is the webmaster of scamicide.com. Check that out. Steve's here now to talk about Social Security and Medicare projections. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, just recently, the federal government released some new projections regarding the finances of Medicare and Social Security, and they're sort of good, because believe it or not, there has been a drop in healthcare costs, and the financial look for Medicare in the future is actually getting a little bit better. In the last forecast, Medicare was supposed to go under in 2028. Now it looks to be fiscally solvent two more years after that. Now, the projections, to a great extent, are as a result of the President's Affordable Care Act, which has sometimes been called Obamacare. And this is something the trustees are seeing a less than expected spending in many service categories. Interestingly enough, including nursing homes, and we're still trying to figure out what's going on there. The costs have been slowing down throughout the healthcare industry, partly because of the recession, but also because of what appears to be some fundamental changes that are aimed at reducing waste and improving health outcomes. So this is something that really looks pretty good for the future, because Medicare is going to be a very expensive program, and so I think we're on the right track. However, Speaking of tracks, the trustees reported no such gains in the finances of Social Security. However, if you want to look at this glass as half full, no real significant deteriorations. So the Social Security trust funds at the moment have enough cash to pay full retirement and disability benefits until 2033. Now, both of these programs, Medicare and Social Security, both face long-term financial problems, particularly as we baby boomers age. So one of the things that actually some people have been concerned about is the fact that the good news with Medicare and Social Security may be doing a little bit better than what had been expected, that Congress might not feel the same kind of pressure to resolve these things. But in point of fact, we really do need to make some changes. And so, for instance, the Social Security Trust Fund, even though it's going to be solvent for decades, the separate fund that we have for Social Security disability benefits is going to run out in 2016 unless Congress acts. And making both programs fully solvent for, say, 75 years would require either an immediate increase in the 12.4% payroll tax of 2.7 percentage points, or a cut in benefits for all beneficiaries of more than 16%. Now, I don't think we're going to see that kind of cut in benefits, but when Social Security had problems before, back during the Reagan years, and frankly it was in worse shape than it is now, just by doing some tinkering and adjusting, it was able to be made much more solvent for many more years. So at least Congress should be talking about this, and talking is the first place to start before action, and hopefully we'll get some reasonable action on both of these. But like Mark Twain's death, perhaps the demise of Medicare and Social Security might be somewhat drastically overstated as well.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Wiseman talking about Social Security and Medicare projections. Thank you, Bev Santinello, our producer on the front line. Thank you, Carol Marks, host and founder of the program. Thank you, Steve Wiseman, as mentioned. Thank you to Kevin Casey, the entire Touch of Gray broadcast team. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.